Hey, J. Crew, we're back in our cozy studio. We're wearing mufflers and sweaters and fleeces. And that's just going to mean that we have to use some lewd language because we're being ourselves. We don't have our guard up. You get the idea? So we're letting it all hang out. So send the kids out of the room. That Stephanie's like, what are you talking about?
I'm like, how am I letting it all hang out if I'm wearing just like so many layers right now?
You're letting some hang out.
The point is,
you're actually hanging out.
We have cabin fever. Yeah.
The point is, you've had your obscenity warning.
It's a lot of like all.
Whoa,
but it's
whoa.
Like if I'm in the middle of like kind of like I'm a little heated about something and I'm like, and then all of a sudden, and I was like, whoa. it's always Ben, and I'm just like, like I try to like catch it and put it back in.
Does Ben shoot you this look like, I thought I'd married a girl who'd been finished at Duke, the fine Methodist institution down south. Hello, J. Crew. This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast. That's according to JewMedia.com, which actually manages the worldwide conspiracy.
And Stormfront.org.
I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined this week by Deputy Editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hello.
Hello. And Tablet Senior Writer Liel Hubel.
Happy Halloween.
Yes, we're recording here on All Hallows. Sid said the funniest thing last night. She referred to last night as Heir of Halloween.
It is. Last night was Heir of All Hallows Eve.
Our Jew of the Week is best-selling author Alice Hoffman, who has a new novel out, her 800th. And our Gentile of the Week is Charles Griggs, a witch and priest in the Minoan Brotherhood, my favorite pagan order. If you're going to have a pagan Wiccan priest on, you want...
We want the right one.
That's right.
Are the Minoans like the Episcopalians of the Wiccans?
With less gin. They're just classy. They're elite.
More eye of newt, less gin and tonic.
That's right. Anyways, so that's good. So it's gonna be a great show, and
so excited about the weekend.
So excited. They are both coming to us live from a studio up north in Boston.
I think it's actually outside of Boston.
It's outside of Boston. It's in the 02138.
Where the magic happens.
Sup, Jews. My parents took Rebecca to see The Battle of the Sexes, the Billie Jean King, Bobby Riggs movie a couple days ago, which apparently is much, much more about Billie Jean King's sexuality than it is. Have you seen it?
No, but I mean, the most amazing part about the film is that it actually sneaks in. Like, you go in thinking it's like this big man-woman thing, and you're like, oh, this actually this like a nuanced portrayal of her and her.
So the way my—oh, Sid was there too, is my parents and Sid and Rebecca, and Sid said, yeah— I think Rebecca was a little confused. Like, she knows there are lesbians, but she couldn't get, well, if she's a lesbian, why was she married?
Well, because she's still, like, so idealistic, and she's like, I don't understand. Even in the, when was it? Like,
right.
So what you're saying, so what you're saying is Rebecca's a Republican.
I'm saying,
basically.
I'm saying, obviously, we haven't, you know, she hasn't been force-fed sex ed before.
Heteronormativity.
Yeah.
Okay, the real question, and do you want to ask it, or should I?
I think you should.
Did they pay for the movie?
I didn't.
How many of them?
And how many kids' tickets did they get?
Now, to be fair, so my parents.
And how many
both...
other movies did they see?
I don't think Sid would. Sid's not a movie cheater. She's not an Oppenheimer.
I love that they do the movie math. Well, we have two seniors and a kid, so they cancel each other out.
Yeah, and Sid, you can come too because
apparently Rebecca had to cover her eyes at certain points during ooh. Delicate lady love, relatively chaste, but to her. Shocking scenes. And
so was asked to cover her eyes or
no,
cover
no, no, no. We didn't ask her to cover her eyes, but she did. And she said, Mommy, tell me when it's over.
There is like this distinct category of movie that I have always just seen with my grandparents. And they're like, there's always just like a graphic sex scene in them.
Yeah,
like, I remember
sure.
I watched 40 Days and 40 Nights. Remember that Josh Hartnett movie with my grandparents?
I
and I was just like, I can't cover my eyes this entire movie. Because nothing actually happens, right?
Like, just getting tired.
And I remember we watched this... I think I've talked about this before, this like Holocaust fencing movie called Sunshine.
You have talked about this before.
And it's like, there's like a sex scene in the woods. And I'm just like, and you know what I mean? It's like
guys, why?
And the closed captioning is on. It's really loud. It's like, we all know what's happening.
I never covered my eyes at anything, you know? I'm kind of proud of this. See, so because we record in Halloween, I will confess that growing up in, you know, the country where the Jews live, I had
New York?
Upper West Side.
Massapequa.
I had a tremendous case of Halloween envy. See, Christmas never appealed to me.
Oh, interesting.
Because it was all about family. I was like, I'm not interested in any of that.
Eight but nights Halloween that I have to spend with my parents.
Was about horror movies and candy. And so every Halloween, I would do my own private celebration in, you know, Herzliya, which involved going to the video store, renting out a movie, and then eating a lot of candy and, you know, watching this movie. And the amazing thing, the video store was was basically run by this 16-year-old. And you could come in as a 9-year-old and be like, can I have Nightmare on Elm Street 5, 6, and 8? And the guy would be like, sure.
I don't see why.
Here you go. And I would go home and I had a VCR in my room. I was like, this is a ooh. Yeah.
You know, I was talking to someone in our office and they didn't grow up. They grew up modern Orthodox. Halloween was just not a thing in her town. Like, it just wasn't. No Jewish family did Halloween. It just, you know, it wasn't as like fraught as it is today for Jews, which for some reason, you know, like the way, you know, it's like, oh, we don't do Halloween. It just, no one did it. So she said, she's like, I get so into Halloween now because I can. And it's not like Christmas. Like, I love Christmas because I never knew. Like, I still actually don't know what day Christmas is. Have I explained this before? Like,
you're not sure if it's the 24th
or the 25th or the 26th. Like, it just never 26. Registered yeah. for me. And I was like, is it always a Saturday? Like,
it's somewhere there in the third week.
I don't know.
Week of
and
December.
That's like a testament to, like, I don't know, the insular. Like, I just will never know it. But
I love this.
So what she was saying was, like, you can go all in, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can go all in on Halloween because it, who cares, right? Like, and so you can't like have a Christmas tree. So I think there are ways in which Jews actually, the ones who do celebrate Halloween, there's a lot of like unrepressed
love for it.
That's
how we connect with America.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Sid, whose Halloween was like pressing the up button.
Yeah, that makes me so sad.
Trick or treating was like you press up in the elevator.
City kids,
go to the fifth floor, or the sixth floor, maybe like old Mrs., you know, Wasserman has some like sad little Brock's candies or something. It's the only time she sews all year is for our kids' Halloween costumes. Like, she really does go. It's like they will not suffer the way girls on the Lower East, the way little matchstick girls on the Lower East Side suffer on Halloween. They are going to have a suburban Halloween with ringing of doorbells and yeah.
We had a hayride once. My dad made it. He had a pickup truck and then we like got bales of hay and he drove my friends around the neighborhood. This is so fun.
At some point, Stephanie, we have to have a really frank conversation about what it's like to have had the best grandparents and the best parents.
Oh my God,
you
seem,
you have a totally unfraught. It's like,
yeah, I'm super well adjusted.
It's unbelievable. It's like your dad, he probably rented two horses, filled a big.
No, but actually our cousins in Israel, you know, like it's always like the Israelis have like, they're the American cousins.
Yeah.
And my sister went over there when she actually met her husband while they were both clerking in Israel.
Cliff, for the
Supreme Court. And we have relatives out there in Ramat HaSharon. And they were like, oh, Francesca, like she had ponies. And Cliff was like, you had ponies? And she's like, no, I did not have ponies. Like this idea. Like,
meanwhile, you know who had a pony?
You had a pony.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Down the street, the pony.
His name was Sandy, and he was an asshole. Just saying.
I feel like ponies have to be assholes. Are we supposed to be like doing something else here? Are we?
You know who's assholes?
We have a show?
You know who's assholes? The people who robbed Mechi's Kosher Deli in Brooklyn.
Indeed.
Last Shabbat, burglars entered through the office of State Senator Simcha Felder, who apparently has an office next to a deli. It's an amazing
with
place.
With a door in between.
They went into the state senator's office.
It's exactly how I would do it if I was a state senator. Find me a deli, build a door, I'm very good.
Yeah, it's like reverse Watergate.
Right, I thought Watergate too. I think the robbers were going to steal sensitive papers.
Kugelgate.
And then we're like, we smell some tongue from next door. Let's go in.
No, the worst part is they didn't even take any like pastrami or anything. They just took like $5,000
just
cash
took the money.
Register. Which is like, you know, a Shonda.
Goyim.
Yeah.
They didn't
what
even
do they know?
No taste.
No taste at all. No pickles. They didn't take any sour
tomatoes.
This is
how the police knows that like the perpetrator was not Jewish.
I just wondered if they like, do you worry that they trafen up the dishes? Like, what if they spilled some milk on the whole
place?
They
just touched everything.
They just touched everything.
No, that's a hate crime.
The whole place, it is.
It is a hate crime. Speaking of food-related news, the Jews, Trader Joe's is now selling Bamba, the Israeli national, the peanut-based snack food that apparently is big in Israel that I've never eaten.
Oh, we should get some after this, right on the way to the office. So here's the thing that I didn't know about Bamba until Tablet published a piece about Bamba.
Yes.
Is that that's why no one in Israel has peanut allergies.
Correct.
Because like children are fed Bamba by the bushel, whatever.
That's
that
right.
Yeah. No, Israelis are very scornful of our peanut allergies they're like, well, just
this
feed
is,
your infants Bamba.
This is true.
And nobody there has them, right?
Nope.
I mean, somebody does.
Hey,
we're going to get mail from like that person who's
no,
kid.
I want to know.
The wee kid.
The wee
kid.
They don't let you into the army if you have a peanut allergy.
No, you have to stay home.
Did you eat a lot of Bamba?
Yes.
I mean, that is my impression. The way they talk about it is like every Israeli child basically sits and eats Bamba all day.
From the moment you're probably, I don't know, like 8 months.
You don't even need
months.
Teeth because it's so
no,
squishy.
No, because it'd be, it's, yeah, it just kind of,
what is an
you put
equivalent
in
America for someone who's listening who has
imagine
never
if
Bamba.
Cheese puffs were made of peanut butter.
Yeah, and they're like a little thicker almost.
Delicious. But also at the same time, a little airier. Because they kind of do really melt in your mouth.
Wow. Sounds amazing.
In basic training, this will say a lot. We kind of had a rotation because oftentimes we would not all get an opportunity to go to the one store that was open on the base that was open for like, you know, 70 seconds in the middle of the day. So we would have a rotation between us, and one guy, it was his job every day to go to the store and get us all Bamba.
He was on Bamba duty? Bamba detail?
He was in Bamba detail because it's the one thing we could not live without. All the other luxuries of civilian life, fine, but don't take away our Bamba.
And do you,
we're
do
men.
Do you still eat Bamba?
Yes. It's amazing.
So are you going to get it from Trader Joe's?
No, I get it from, you know.
He knows a guy.
I got to tell
you. He knows a guy who knows a guy.
As happy as I am that Trader Joe's is carrying it, a part of me is like all like Israeli nationalist chauvinist, like, what do you mean they're taking the Bamba away? This is our Bamba. It's not your snack.
But is it going to have like a Trader Joe's logo slapped on
yes,
it and
it
stuff
is,
like that?
Yes.
So it's like, yeah.
And elephants with yarmulkes.
Really?
I'm not even kidding. Yeah.
So
the logo
offensive.
Is kind of like, ugh.
I want to follow up Stephanie's shrewd question about what is the equivalent here. And you said it was like cheese puffs, but if they were both airier and more substantial, which is really is Israeli magic. They're both lighter and heavier.
Correct.
But what I want to ask is, like, somebody once told me that I was once in a conversation, I think at my shul, with somebody about the class connotations of Bamba. Because it's like here these days, a lot of parents we know, I mean, I'll feed my kid cheese puffs because I'll feed them anything, but wouldn't feed their kids like cheese puffs or Cheez-Os or Cheez-Its or whatever. And I was like, is it like that with Bamba? And the person was saying, well, her argument was, yes, it is seen as kind of a trashy snack, but everyone loves it anyway. Is that accurate?
No, I don't think it is. First of all, it came to the game kind of late. Bamba was invented in the mid-60s.
Invaded?
Invented.
You did say invaded.
Invaded? You did. You Bamba did. Was invaded by the Lebanese in 90.
And then again by Trader Joe's.
That is what the
annexed.
Fourth Lebanon War is about. Right. It was invented in the late 60s. And then Beastly, which, by the way,
oh,
is,
yeah, so
it,
good.
In my opinion, the superior snack, was invented in the late 70s, and it was such a novelty that the company had Awesome, which makes them, had to literally invent a word for snack, which did not exist in Hebrew. It's like, what is this new thing? It's like, a thing that you grab? And so they call it chatif, which is literally the thing that you grab, right? That is the Hebrew meaning of it.
Grabos.
The grabo, right? The grab thing.
But I love the idea that like Israelis ate you eat to live, kind of. Like, and then all of a sudden it's like, a snack.
That's
what
right.
is a snack?
So we didn't even have time to develop this class distinction because it literally came to be as I was, you know, growing up. It's like, oh, that thing, awesome. Like, we'll all eat it. And the way that they did it is amazing. They had no idea what flavor was supposed to be. So they literally tried every flavor in the factory, took it across the street to a high school, left 5 bowls outside like bird food, and like looked at which one the students emptied first. Be like, we'll make this flavor. The kids like this the best. And it's amazing. It's an amazing snack.
That was like the first focus group.
This is 1977.
Israeli.
We've just learned a lot.
Sabra ingenuity. Mandy Moore, this is an important story for reasons that are about to become apparent. Mandy Moore, who used to be married to
Ryan Adams,
thank you, is engaged to Taylor Goldsmith, the lead singer of the band Dawes, and who is a Jew, apparently. This is an important story for two reasons. Number one, I really like the band Dawes, and it's one of the only concerts I've ever persuaded Sid to go to with me. Sid doesn't do concerts because they're loud, but she went to see Dawes with me. The other thing is because Mandy Moore, in addition to being in the weekly tearjerker, NBC tearjerker, This Is Us, is also the star of Sid's favorite movie ever, American Dreams, which was a little known comedy. Was Dennis Quaid in it?
Yes, he was.
That it turns out, when I was mentioning this on our conference call the other night, there's one other American, other human.
One other person.
Who remembers this movie fondly, and it's Liel Leibowitz.
Absolutely. Who else wastes his time with?
Who immediately started singing, as Sid always does when this movie comes up, American
Dreams. Dreams with a Z.
Dreams with a Z.
Wait, that's actually the song?
Yes.
Yep.
Oh my God.
It's a movie that it's a mashup of a movie about an American Idol-like reality show and an Al-Qaeda spy ring.
Wow, no spoilers.
No spoilers, just to tell you.
Who do they pick? Do they pick Adam Levine?
If you're in the kind of like population crossover genre that likes that kind of thing, if you like some terrorist plots and singing competition,
this is your movie.
Really, your movie.
I'm just happy Mandy's happy.
Yeah,
you know,
me too.
Ryan Adams, it didn't go well. He like, she had all these pets all of a sudden that they had adopted and she had to take care of them and she like sued for pet support.
She did?
Just like,
I missed
yeah,
that story.
Which I think is actually a really important way to start thinking about things.
If you and Ben split, who would Cat Stevens go with? Actually, there's no way Ben would take Cat Stevens.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Never mind. But, I mean, yes, we wish Mandy Moore nothing but the best, all sorts of mazels.
Maybe they'll have a Walk to Remember down the aisle.
Would you say that she has a type going from one, you know, scruffy alt-rock singer to another scruffy alt-rock singer? I mean, you might say
begrudge her that.
You might say if the Ryan Adams thing didn't work out, going for like JV Ryan Adams is not the strongest.
Does JV stand for Jewish Varsity?
Jewish Varsity.
Jewish Variety.
She needed a Jewish Ryan Adams.
Yeah, basically.
And she found one. Anyway, big mazel tov to future Gentile of the Week, Mandy Moore.
Who's Mandy Goldsmith. Definitely went to camp with her.
And a final and most important bit of news of the Jews. This came in as a tip from listener David Harnash. We heard about it from him first, though it has since blown up in the Jewosphere. A train in Germany. Leo, you should really tell us this story.
So Deutsche Bahn, the German railway company, was having a meeting. It's like, you know what would be cool and creative? If we had a competition to name the trains after famous people. Who can we name the German train after? And of course, the chosen name is Anne Frank.
The Anne Frank.
So because why wouldn't you?
This is basically like the Bodie McBoatface drama of Germany.
Yes.
So that was that they like offered, they had a contest to name a boat.
In England, right.
In England, yes. But Bodie McBoatface did not carry 6 million Bodies to their drowny death, right? And Deutsche Bahn, who before that was Deutsche, they had a different name, which had, you know, Reich in it,
right.
But did actually take, millions of people to their untimely demise. So, don't do that.
Generous reading where it's like, we are so aware that we are going to do this and we're all going to be thinking about this all the time.
That's what they said. It's like, but we found that a name that connoted the universal, you know, appeal to human brotherhood. It's
hold
like,
on.
Right, you also killed 6 million people. Let's not do that.
Let me read from the BBC piece. Jury member Professor, Herr Dr. Frau Dr. Professor Gisela Metteler said there was impressive diversity in the many famous names suggested by the public.
You have to do the accent.
The ones selected have one thing in common. They were curious about the world. That was Anne Frank's. That's why they selected
her. Und we nipped it in the bud.
The 25 include some wartime dissidents who died resisting the Nazis, Hans and Sophie Scholl, and the theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. They also include former German chancellors Konrad Adenauer, Ludwig Erhard, and Willy Brandt.
First, the trains came
as well as
from Munich, but I didn't get on because I wasn't going to Munich. But by the time the train came for me, there was no one to get,
on, to get on the train. As well as philosophers Hannah Arendt and Karl Marx. There are two trains.
Yeah.
So there's the Hannah Arendt, the Karl Marx. ICE trains will also be named after novelist Thomas Mann, music maestro Ludwig van Beethoven, and actress and singer Marlene Dietrich.
Wow.
But on the one, okay, so on the one hand, it's
guys, don't you have like soccer stars or something? Like, just be normal, Germany. We get it, okay?
I mean, on the one hand, this is ridiculous, or as the Germans would say, ridiculous. But on the other hand, like in America, we'd be naming them after like Derek Jeter.
That's
so
amazing,
it's
because,
like the Beethoven and the Thomas Mann does say something. It speaks well of their.
Yeah, I mean, there is. I don't know. Look, I think at this point, Anne Frank is.
She belongs to us all.
No, I mean, she. All of us and none of us, right? Like, she has actually, I'm totally serious. There's a way in which her ubiquity is actually usurping her legacy in a lot of ways. Like, okay, we slap Anne Frank on a soccer jersey. Football jersey. Like, we put her on a train. It's like,
we did put her on a train. That's kind of the problem that we did once upon a time.
Actually, she was never on a train. She was just, oh no, it's probably from her attic. There probably was a train, yeah.
There was a train.
To me, it's like the dilution of her legacy. First of all, we are so obsessed with her, and then she's just sort of become everywhere and everything, so sort of less meaningful.
And yet, I still haven't read The Diary of Anne Frank.
And one day you will.
One day
I think
I
you
will.
Should do it in the air.
Is
I think
there
this
an
should
audiobook?
Be its own podcast. It's Mark, exactly. Mark podcasting Anne Frank's Diary.
And it's played at the beginning of Italian football games.
It's right. It's chapter after chapter.
Why don't you do an audiobook?
With running commentary.
All around the water tank, waiting for a train. 1,000 miles away from home, sleeping in the rain.
Some newsletter subscribers. We are oh so excited to welcome the new law firm of Grace Davidson, Susie Shalom, Sammy Klaskin, Peter Francis Aiello, and Madeline Lonkey. Madeline Lonnke is a very special addition to the Subscriber family.
Absolutely.
We're very excited that she made partner. Right. Liel, who is Madeline Lonnke?
Well, you know of two brothers. You know of Thor and Lonnke.
Yes.
But there was a third one, Lonnke. Mm-hmm. Lonnke was the Jewish brother. You know, he was Odin's Jewish son from his first marriage to Madeline Schwartz. And he was, you know, he was the smart one. He did not fight civil wars with the other Marvel
a good soldier.
Superheroes. Yep. No, nothing like no Ragnarok for him.
Yep.
He came onto Earth. He left the gods, and he
got a job as an actuary.
He opened a law firm. Yeah. He did very well for himself, and of him. All Lonnkes have
since
so
descended.
When does he get his own movie?
Starring Judd Hirsch as Lonnke.
As Lonnke. The newsletter is not the regular tablet newsletter. Oh, no. Nothing against the regular tablet newsletter, which is a newsletter you should get. But for an extra special spiritual experience, get the tablet newsletter handwritten.
By a maniac.
With a quill and then transcribed onto a computer. By Liel Leibowitz. You can get it by visiting our website to sign up for it, tabletmag.com, or sending an email asking for it, pleading for it to unorthodox@tabletmag.com. You know, put newsletter in the subject line. Also, we're doing an advice show coming up soon. If you have questions, if you want any advice, if you want our wisdom, send us a question at unorthodox@tabletmag.com and put advice or help me in the subject line.
SOS.
While you're at it, rate us on iTunes and join the Facebook group. And when you join the Facebook group, add your 100 best friends or worst enemies to the Facebook group. If you really want to get an anti-Semite, add them to the Unorthodox Facebook group.
And just do at David Duke and press enter.
Our Jewish guest this week is Alice Hoffman. She has written everything. She's written The Dove Keepers. She's written Practical Magic. And now she's back with the prequel to Practical Magic. It's called The Rules of Magic. It's wonderful. And it was out this month just in time for Halloween. And we're so excited, Alice, to have you here with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what made you decide to go back? You know, Practical Magic was written in the 90s. It obviously became a movie with Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman. A lot of people are probably watching it tonight on Halloween. What made you want to go back and revisit the story?
Well, you know, I always felt like there was more to that family. I feel like, and I'm interested in going back in time. I'm writing about the 60s and the Rules of Magic, which is the time that I grew up. But I think it's really an important time to look back to right now.
Why specifically?
Because it was a time when, you know, the country was so divided as it is now, and it was a time when there were so many different cultural changes and changes in attitudes about women and gays and lesbians and outsiders of all kinds. And I just feel like there's a lot for us to learn looking backwards at that time about all that we managed to accomplish. To change.
I do think it's interesting you mentioned outsiders. A book that recently came up in our household was a book you wrote in 1988, At Risk, about the girl who gets AIDS from a blood transfusion.
Yeah.
And that was an incredibly early time to have been writing about AIDS. I mean, that means you were probably writing in 86, 87 when you know, the disease was still very, very new. And I'm curious what was that like for you? What was the reception of that? Did that get a lot of attention at the time? I couldn't quite remember. I know it as a book that we're probably going to give one of our daughters now.
Yeah, it did get a lot of attention, and it's still being read, especially in high schools, because it's so much about how do you treat an outsider or someone that's viewed as an outsider. You know, I think the reason that I wrote it was because I was pregnant at the time, and I was just thinking about, you know, when you're pregnant, when you have a child, how you go over to the other side, really, and you have so much to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was the kind – at that time, I mean, it's hard to kind of believe it now for people who are younger, but at that time, you know, nobody talked about it. It was really a divisive issue. People didn't want to go to school with someone that had AIDS. I mean, it was just horrendous the way people were being treated.
So this is what you wrote as a sort of kind of like calming down, soothing book while you're being pregnant. Sort of like feel good.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to write it to know it, I think.
But I wanted to ask, and this goes back to what Mark was saying. It seems like so much of what you do, it has this kind of uncanny way of being, you know, 10, 15 years ahead of the cultural curve. Even, you know, like Practical Magic, that came out in a time way before these issues and these themes became kind of like, you know, pop culture nerdy obsessions. What's going on here? What do you know?
Yeah.
And how do you know it?
And what's coming next?
Well, you know, it's so funny you say that because I always think that the writer is much smarter than the person. And I feel like, you know, things I know as a writer, I don't know as a person. And partially I'm writing these books because I have questions and I don't have the answers. And the only way to find out is to write it. And it's funny with Practical Magic. I just read in Time magazine that witches have voted it their most beloved movie, the best movie about witches, which made me feel really good. Because, you know, it's about family. And that's what it's really about. It's not so much about witches. It's about sisterhood. It's about women. It's about family.
And sorry, witches really love you, right? Like you are totally welcomed and like lauded for your spot on work, basically.
I think so because, you know, I'm kind of like, I'm trying to kind of redefine the popular mythology that was kind of the twisted version of what a witch is. And, you know, it's so interesting just in terms of being Jewish that when I did research about the Spanish Inquisition for a book I wrote for teens called Incantation, I was really surprised to discover that Spain and Portugal were the only two European countries that did not have witch hunts because the Inquisition served the same purpose. You go after
So they were going after Jews
after
instead.
Yeah. Exactly.
So witches, you're welcome. We took the heat for you in Spain and Portugal.
Yeah, right. That's true.
So your books are, not all of them, but a lot of them are pretty much in what you'd call the fantasy genre. That's a genre Liel enjoys very much, my co-host Liel. Are you into fantasy, Stephanie? Besides Alice Hoffman. When it's not Alice Hoffman, do you read a lot of fantasy?
No, I do read a lot of Alice Hoffman.
You do read a lot of Alice Hoffman, though.
It's
I feel
funny
that's common, right? I mean...
Well, it's funny you should say that because I'm one of these people, I don't believe in genres. And I think, you know, when I was starting out as a writer, if you wrote about magic in any way, you were a fantasy and science fiction writer. And I actually grew up reading fantasy and science fiction. I love it. But I think as time went on, people decided to call certain things magic realism. If they thought it was literary, it would be magic realism. Mm-hmm. And I think now certain writers that would have not been accepted as mainstream literary writers, like a writer like Ursula Le Guin, who writes fantasy and science fiction, she's considered a writer, period. You know, so I have, you know, I don't mind being called somebody who writes magic realism, but to tell you the truth, I think that's the original literature anyway. I mean, I think magic is always in literature, the original literature, whether it's folk tales or myth or fairy tales. So, I kind of don't get this kind of division of literature into genres so much. If it's a great book, it's a great book.
I also think it serves to work against largely female writers who are saying, oh, they're romance writers, oh, they're fantasy writers, as opposed to just writers.
It does, I have to say. That's true.
Yeah, although
that's true.
Although to the extent that I have regrettable anti-fantasy or anti-sci-fi prejudices, they're about men in their basements, not about women.
Yes. You know, funny you should say that because, you know, one of the reasons I started reading science fiction and fantasy is because my father left, and he left a box of books in the basement.
Alice, you've written 800 books. Do you remember them? Do you remember them all?
Like,
right. I've written only 3 books, and I have no idea what I said in the first one. I mean, there must be, if I quizzed you on the plot of book number 12, you wouldn't remember, right?
You know, I remember some things, but not others. And the way I think about it is this, and maybe you do too. I think it's like being an actor. You're in a play, and when that play is over,
you forget the lines.
You're going on to another play.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't remember the lines of every play.
Right.
I think you wouldn't be able to talk then.
Right. Although I once knew an actor who said he remembered the lines of every play he'd been in. I was
really
flabbergasted. Yeah. It seemed inhuman, but well, that's good.
Yeah, I think you only have so much space in your brain, so that actor is probably going to, I don't know, implode.
So we need to talk about The Dove Keepers. I feel like of our listenership, that is, like if I could say, like raise your hand if you've read that, that's like where everyone is cheering in the audience. Do people come up to you and tell you like their Dove Keepers moment?
Some of them do, yeah, they do. Well, you know, I mean, I had my own Dove Keepers moment. I think, you know, I didn't expect to write that book, and I felt like the reason I did really was because my son was an archaeologist, and he was working in Israel, and, you know, we didn't have much in common. He didn't read books, and he didn't read fiction, but when he started to talk about archaeology, I realized he was talking about telling stories. So I went to Israel to meet him, and then while I was there, I went with my family to Masada in August, which nobody told me.
Yeah.
Good call.
But the great thing is no one else was there except for us. And when I got to the top, I just felt like I had a spiritual experience that I didn't expect to have. And I felt like I could hear the voices of the people who were there, especially the women, because I had stopped in the museum and I saw all the amazing artifacts that had belonged to women. And, you know, I still didn't think of it as a book at all. But as I was walking around, I saw a little plaque that said there had been survivors. And as soon as I saw that there had been survivors, I felt like maybe this is a book.
Hmm.
And The Dove Keepers, for people who don't know, is, you know, tells a story about, I think, three women at what happens after, basically. I actually was reading it while I was on Birthright, like right before we went to Masada. Oh. So that was amazing for me.
Wow. Yeah, well, for me, I really wrote in the voices of four women, and I knew two women survived. That was what Josephus said, so I'm going on his account. But I didn't know while I was writing the book which of the four women, who would live and who would die. So for me, it was kind of, it was a page turner for me. I wanted to find out what happened.
Now, you're from Long Island, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, we just have to establish how far from Stephanie you grew up. Where are you from?
Where did you grow up,
Stephanie? I grew up in Great Neck.
I grew up far from there.
Okay.
I grew up in Hempstead, Franklin Square, kind of a cement-ish Levittown sort of place.
Well, that sounds horrible.
Well, it kind of made me believe in magic.
you had to escape to the books in the basement.
So speaking of which, what comes next? Tell us where the culture is headed. Tell us what we have to fear right around the bend.
Well, I have to say, I was working on a book about real estate in New York, and I stopped writing that right after the election.
I wonder why.
Yeah. Too real.
So, too real. I'm still interested in, I'm always interested in New York City. I'm working on a book, but I feel like, you know, until it's done, I feel like I can't really talk about it because you never know if a book's going to completely come alive until you finish. And, you know, I've done a lot of research and I've traveled, but I still don't know if it's really the book. And I won't know probably for another 6 months.
Well, I hope it holds some rosy future for humanity, you know. Because we could use
Well,
some.
You know, to tell you the truth, I'm always interested in survivors because I feel like, you know, I don't understand how people manage to survive the things they do. And I'm always feel like that's my field of study, is to study survivors.
Alice, thank you so much. This was wonderful. And happy Halloween.
Oh, thank you. Happy Halloween to you,
too. How do you
too.
Celebrate? What's your Halloween routine?
Oh, I'm having a party. What about you?
This year I'm giving out the I'm taking the kids door to door.
Oh yeah, because you have to split up.
And Sid's giving out the candy. Yeah.
Oh well, that's good.
Which is interesting because giving out the candy is more social. So she usually leaves that to me because I like gabbing with everyone who comes by. But this year she wants to do that. So. Yeah.
Well, once your kids grow up, you can have a party.
All right. Is that what adults do on Halloween?
Yeah, that's what
child
we do.
Child-free adults do on Halloween.
We have a lot to look forward to.
Thanks, Alice.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Great to talk to you.
Raven hair and ruby lips, sparks fly from her fingertips. Ooh, witchy woman, see how high she flies.
All right, our Gentile of the Week is Charles Griggs. He is a witch and priest in the Minoan Brotherhood. He's been practicing in the pagan world for 13 years, which makes him, I think, a bar mitzvah. And he's also studying at the Harvard Divinity School. Welcome, Charles.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Have you ever been a Gentile of the Week before?
I have not. I'm super excited. What's going to happen?
That's a good question. Anything
see.
Is possible.
It's Halloween. It's when the Jews come out.
That's right.
Yeah. So is Halloween considered offensive? I know it's. Is it Samhain?
So the way that it's usually pronounced is Samhain or Samhain, depending upon which dialect you're speaking in. Halloween is perfectly fine because it was appropriated from pagan religions, but it has become a religious holiday for some people, and it's a time for others to party. But, you know, it has numerous dimensions, and nobody really owns the word.
Okay, so tonight, when we heathens go out and eat, you know, little Kit Kats and watch
– put razor blades in apples.
Right. What do you guys do?
So Samhain is usually about honoring the dead. What would happen is we normally would all get together and meditate, have some quiet time, and then what we would do is cast a circle with something called an athame usually, which is a ceremonial blade that's used to symbolically cut space to put you between the worlds of the goddesses and gods and the world of humankind. And then we would invoke the goddess and gods after calling the spirits of the four directions. And we would recite a small liturgy about the process that's happening theologically right now. And after that, we might also take time to remember our mighty dead who have passed this year. Mighty dead were practitioners, and then also our family members who we don't call mighty dead because we respect that while they may not have practiced in our religion, we still want to remember them.
So no fun-sized candy.
There might be fun-sized candy afterwards. There's always a feast. I mean, it is supposed to be a party. We believe in mirth and reverence, and you can't have one without the other.
I like that. I think that's true. Mirth without reverence is frivolous, and reverence without mirth is boring. You can put
that's
that. Right. You can put that on your letterhead. So I'm guessing because your name is Charles Griggs that you grew up a lapsed Episcopalian.
Evangelical United Methodist from Alabama.
Oh, okay. Well, that was my next guess. So that's an even stranger journey then. If you grew up Evangelical UMC from Alabama, how did you end up a priest of the Minoan tradition?
I think like a lot of people who are very spiritual and devotional, I had mystical and ecstatic experiences as a young child. And I went looking for answers to, you know, what this all meant. I think that religion's a great way to make meaning of our experiences. And I cycled through a lot of reading and a lot of tagging around my family's church because my dad is also a minister, so priesthood is kind of a thing, I guess. And I ended up in a type of Gardnerian Wicca to start with, which is very heteronormative. And while a lot of people find that enriching, and I've actually met very few heterosexual priests in Gardnerian Wicca, I really needed something that spoke to me as a gay man because, the charge of the goddess says that she is that which is attained at the end of desire. And I didn't think that I could appropriately explore my desires as a gay man in a sacred way, being in a tradition that was really structured for heterosexuals. And so that's how I ended up in the Minoan Brotherhood. It's open to all men who love men and also men who don't love men as long as they're comfortable being around a bunch of gay men.
Well, I mean, that's interesting to me because as a journalist, I spent some time in Wiccan traditions and all of them seem to be heavily populated with gay men. I mean, I was never in a space that I felt wasn't a little bit queer, to be frank. Mm-hmm. I mean, was the tradition that you were in not hospitable to gay men was it not a very gay tradition?
Well, it is very gay in population, but the gods are usually functionally heterosexual. I mean, the whole thing is based around showing you the mystery of the tradition, which is the divine union of the feminine and masculine principle. And so that really gives off more of a fertility cult vibe. And while there are figurative ways to take fertility, it's not something that gay men can actually engage in with their same-sex partners most of the time. Meanwhile, the Minoan Brotherhood is a tradition of witchcraft that really embraces ecstasy as equal to fertility. And so it doesn't have like a family as the end means of all of its rituals.
Speaking of family, you know, yours is deeply kind of ingrained in the church. How did they take your spiritual journey?
We agree to disagree and we're all on our best behavior. I mean, I came out of the broom closet, so to speak, at a very young age. And, you know, they've had 13 years of being aware that this was a part of my life, even though I tried to get rid of it. And so I guess when it comes down to it at the end of the day, there has to be some respect that this is what my father would call my calling, although I don't think he would admit it.
But it strikes me, and maybe it's just because, you know, I'm a Jew who tends to see persecution everywhere. It strikes me that really your tradition is one of very, very few that is still kind of, you know, misunderstood, disrespected. I feel like you could walk in and say, like, I'm just about anything, and people be like, oh, that's really interesting. But you say that, well, I'm in the Manilan tradition, people be like, what? Like, are you kooky? Like, are you out of your mind? Do you get that, or am I just being oversensitive?
I definitely get that, and there is an unspoken perception, I think, that I'm probably a little kooky by most people. And I think a lot of that is the ingrained Puritanism that we still have in American culture, because, you know, witchcraft as a religion is very embracing of all aspects of life, and there is not really a gigantic divide between the sacred and the profane. We learn to see one and the other. And so I think that's probably what scares people most. And so I usually just say I'm a pagan. If it comes down to it, and if it doesn't, then it doesn't. It's usually something that we have to kind of scaffold up to get people to understand that witches are not interested in eating their children.
So let's step back a little bit. So how are witches different from pagans? Let's like try to dispel some ignorance while we can on this show.
Thank you for asking. That's a really important question, actually. Modern pagans are usually more focused at its very base level. Paganism is focused on exoteric and celebratory practices that seek to attune people with the cycles of the earth. And you don't really need any training whatsoever to be a pagan. Once you get to being a witch in the way that I was trained, and not everyone will agree with me, but once you get to being a witch, there is an initiation and training that has to happen, which makes you a priestess or priest and a technician of the sacred. So there's a much more esoteric knowledge that has to happen. And so really, one is more celebratory, one is more initiatory, but there are myriad types of different witches and pagans throughout the community.
When you say esoteric knowledge, I think most of our listeners are thinking he's talking about, you know, Eye of Newt and magic. I mean, say more about that, because I'm actually really interested in the technical side of things.
And one thing you should understand, Charles, is that Liel's a bit of a seeker himself. Like the odds are, you know, between 1% and 3% that he could end his days as a Minoan.
Priest. I just have, you know, profound, being myself a religious human, I have profound respect for all other religious humans.
No, but I'm saying of the three of us, you're the most likely to have had some of these experiences as a kid.
I would say of the three of us, I'm the most likely to anything.
To anything.
Whatever it is that you say, that's true.
Fair enough.
Back to you, Charles.
So, interesting fact, Eye of Newt is actually just a mustard seed.
Wow.
Well, I love mustard. That's my thing.
That's like trendy.
That's
too.
My jam. I love mustard seed.
Yeah, I was actually just brewing up some essential oils with my partner to also help him with some issues in his life, because, you know, and that's kind of the more exoteric stuff, delving into the herbs and things that are accessible to everybody. Esoteric knowledge, I think, for witches is really built within community, because once you get initiated into a coven in most mainstream versions of witchcraft, or a grove in the Minoan Brotherhood, what happens is that you become very close to these people, because you do share things that, you know, are oath-bound, and it's kind of like a family. And so the esoteric knowledge that you get is really more based upon a sense of mystery that you share with your immediate grove or coven, but then also a sense of mystery that you share with the greater tradition itself. And what's interesting about that is that witchcraft, as I practice it in my family of traditions that I'm related to, is not an orthodoxy. There's no absolute correct belief. It's an orthopraxy. And so what happens with the orthopraxy is that everyone goes through the same initiations and elevations up until you get to third degree. But the thing is that since you're not told you have to believe about it in a certain way, everyone has a different experience. And so it's really a beautiful thing where we can celebrate our diversity and the fact that your mileage may vary.
as the sacred texts say.
As the sacred text says, yes.
There are ways in which I've noticed in popular female culture right now that like words like witches and coven, like coven essentially can, for a lot of people, means like squad. Is that something that bothers you, or is there a sense in which like if everyone is thinking that coven is really cool, then that actually is great for larger, you know, stereotypes and things like that?
You know, I'm really glad that witchcraft and this terminology is enjoying a resurgence in popular culture. I'm not so hot on the fact that, you know, people are turning into IRAB priests and priestesses. And, you know, the IRAB tradition is just, I read a book. You don't get initiated. You don't get initiated from reading a book. And so while I'm really happy that people are using these terms and learning more about them, I think that part of spiritual life and one of the eight Wiccan virtues mentioned in the Charge of the Goddess is actually humility. And so there's a certain point where one has to have humility and say, well, I can't learn everything from Google. And there is a lot of oral lore and lore in sacred texts, which are only passed by hand and by copying, that you're just not going to get on the internet and from popular culture. And so while I'm glad that it's happening, I also think that you know, we all need to be willing to learn something. I'm learning something new every day. I didn't know what a supreme was. I was ignorant.
Listen, as
Diana Ross.
Yeah, as a Jew, let me tell you what's going to happen to you guys. Pretty soon you're going to have cultural Wiccans. You're going to be people, look, I don't really know anything, but I really enjoy Eye of Newt, so I'm kind of Wiccan just because I like this food that I eat.
Hey, Charles, you, as a Gentile of the Week, one of the privileges, one of the esoteric privileges having been inducted into our podcast is you get to ask us a question about Judaism or Jewish practice or Jewish culture that we, an internationally recognized panel of experts, can answer for you. What question do you have for us?
So it's actually one I've been wrestling with quite a bit too. In witchcraft and occultism, the Kabbalah is fairly prevalent due to things like the Golden Dawn, which was an initiatory hermetic order, and then, you know, witchcraft absorbing that because, you know, Doreen Valiente, who wrote a lot of our liturgy, said, if it works, use it. And so people have been using Kabbalah kind of indiscriminately without getting much training from Jewish masters of it or Jewish teachers of it. And I was wondering how you feel about non-Jews using Kabbalah in a way that's maybe not necessarily very Jewish or even informed by the Jewish tradition anymore.
Listen, between a Harvard Divinity student and Madonna, yeah, we're happy. I would say this in all honesty. I'm a student of Kabbalah myself, a relatively new one, just a few years. I think that while I certainly locate it within the Jewish tradition and within Jewish theology, I certainly believe that it's wisdom, as do the wisdoms of, you know, all spiritual human teachings. It transcends specificities and boundaries and categories, and I'm personally delighted whenever anyone takes any interest in anything, let alone something as meaningful and as beautiful as Kabbalah. So, you know, la briut, as they say in Hebrew. Gesunterheit.
There's a way in which this sort of reflects my last question to you, which was like, I don't know, if you see someone wearing a red bracelet, right, like this Kabbalah string, mm-hmm. and you know it's not meaningful, like they don't know the story behind it. They're just saying like, oh, look, I have a patch on my backpack and it says like coven because I'm like, I'm very like woke essentially, but I have no idea what it means and what its significance is. So I think there's a way in which it sort of works both ways.
Yeah, I mean, I personally am always in favor of people appropriating Judaism, culturally appropriating Judaism for whatever works for them. I mean, if it makes you feel more spiritual to grow sidelocks or wear a yarmulke, like, you know, Gesunterheit, as Liel said. But I also agree with Stephanie that if I may rephrase, if I may give my version of what I think Stephanie was getting at.
Marksplain, yes.
If I can marksplain, I mean, well, if I could give my more cynical version of what you were diplomatic and polite about saying, a lot within Judaism, a lot of the people who dabble in Kabbalah just seem silly because they get they buy a little Kabbalah water, they wear a red bracelet, and they read like one book. They are IRABs. They are IRAB Kabbalists. And, yeah, and Kabbalah is like, it is stuff people spend decades. It is really difficult, really obscure, and really misunderstood. And so it's like within Judaism, a professed interest in Kabbalah is like the number one signifier that you're a dilettante.
Man, I hear you, but at the same time, any step that you take to open the heart, you know, any at all.
Don't Liel-splain me and make me look like a douche.
Welcome.
Why you got to make me look like a hater?
You know?
This is, by the way, the opposite of how these conversations usually go.
Because so I'm
Charles,
the lover.
Thank you.
If the red string fits, I have to wear it.
That's exactly.
Oh my God.
Liel is usually our militant orthodoxy bound right. person, and Mark is sort of like go with the flow. But so apparently we found something that has changed the narrative.
And all it took is a priest.
I have a cultural appropriation question for you, Charles, okay. which is we adopted two cats about 13 years ago. They're dearly departed. They've gone to the great grove in the sky, if I may syncretistically fuse all sorts of traditions there. One of them was named Emigre, like the French emigre to an emigrant, E-M-I-G-R-E, mm-hmm, with an accent. Mm-hmm. The other one was named Samhain, after the Wiccan holiday. Are you okay with some, you know, hipster in Somerville, Mass, naming their cat that we ended up adopting Samhain?
Well, sure. Do what makes you feel spiritual. Grow your sidewalks.
As long as she doesn't wear like a Kabbalah string around her neck, that would just be too much. So Charles, is there a traditional greeting that you would give tonight that we can give you?
One of the most common pagan greetings is Blessed Be.
Blessed be.
Blessed be.
Thanks, Charles.
Thanks, Charles.
Those fingers in my hair, that sly come hither stare, that strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft.
Guys, for the mailbox this week, I want to catch up on an old letter. It just never made it on. It was lurking there. Just never inserted itself, never spoke up, never raised its hand.
We couldn't get to inbox zero because it was there.
That's
yep.
right.
Yep. Time to get to inbox zero. It's from way back. Dear Unorthodox, I never mailed to you about your Camp Stories episode, though as a Kinderland alum, I take issue with the idea that everyone there is an asshole. But anyway, you recently mentioned yoni, the Sanskrit for vagina, literally vessel, and I finally had to write something. When I was at Kinderland, campers were allowed to choose an elective or a choice each week. One week, I chose the feminist choice. At first, we were just a bunch of grade schoolers reading from the vagina monologues, but later we celebrated our new womanly pride by crafting yoni jewelry, anatomically correct necklaces and bracelets. We didn't have much use for our new jewelry later in the week. Fortunately, there was a boy in my year named Yoni. We gave him all the jewelry we had made, and I believe he proudly wore an entire treasure chest of vagina-shaped accessories for the rest of the summer. All my love to Stephanie and mild contempt to Liel, Naomi.
Wow, Naomi, that's amazing. I also feel like you could sell
mild
those.
Mild contempt is like, should be a new blessing.
Mild contempt. MC.
I think Yoni got really laid that summer.
Yoni was like 11, Liel.
What do you mean? Your culture, this is not the
Yoni
age for this sexual
eternal?
Relation?
Yoni is eternal. First of all, I love that they were ahead of Gwyneth on... Well, maybe they weren't. I don't know when... They must have been.
They
this
were.
Was 10 or 15 years ago. They were ahead of Gwyneth on the Yoni thing. The Yoni train. Riding the Yoni train. Second, if somebody out there in Listenerland could find for us this boy Yoni, who went to Camp Kinderland, I'm guessing 10, 15 years ago, and got all the Yoni
and
jewelry.
And walked around with vagina-shaped...
This would be our equivalent of... I think NPR did a story and like in it... about some village somewhere and someone was wearing like a bar mitzvah t-shirt that was obviously like from an American kid's bar mitzvah. And then they tracked down
whose bar mitzvah it was.
It's amazing.
Mazel tovs, Stephanie Butnick. Do you have a mazel tov?
My mazel tov is to listener Hannah Lonke, who came up to me after the live show and told me that because of our episode with cat therapist Carol Wilburn, she got a second cat. And she said that she had never, like, until hearing my account of Cat Stevens, she was like, I just thought I was alone and, like, had this crazy cat. And she's like, but then single cat syndrome. Like, I got another cat. She said it was a little tough, but they're happy.
Single cat syndrome is real.
I love that.
It's a real affliction.
I love that our show empowered her to get a second cat.
Like, yeah, and she's like, you need to do it. And I was like, send me an email and tell me everything. And she did.
And are you going to get a second cat?
This apartment's too small.
Uh-huh. Liel, mazel tov.
My mazel tov is to my friend Daniel Trimond, who is now a lawyer.
He passed the bar.
He passed the bar. I was going to shout him out at the live show, which he attended. But
you forgot.
It turns out that a lot of mezcal does really funny things to your brain.
My mazel tov is to Kate Vogel and Mike Schechter. They invited us to their children's baby naming. We did not have the time to acquire transportation to Anchorage, Alaska, which is where they live. So we were not able to make the baby naming. But if it had been in the tri-state area, we would have gone. Make no mistake, I would have been there. Their twins are Maximus Joseph and Zoe Madeline. And mazel tov to all four of them.
Maximus.
And Zoe. Maximus and Zoe are – that's a superhero duo. That is the Wonder Twins.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Follow us and join our Facebook group. Go to facebook.com, go to the Tablet webpage, and then look at groups, and we are Unorthodox Podcast. Almost 500 of you have joined already, so I want to get to 1,000. It's not really Mushbucha until there are 1,000 of you.
It's a minion, a Facebook minion.
It's not a Facebook minion until we
That's the AJ Jacobs motto.
That's right.
It's not really a Mushbucha until there are 1,000 of
thousands
us.
Thousands and thousands of you. Follow Stephanie on Instagram at sbutnick. Our show is produced by Alyssa Goldstein and Shira Talushkin with help from Julia Frakes. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our show is edited by Noah Levinson. Our music is by Golem. Rabbinic supervision this week by cantor Sherry Allen of Arlington, Texas, and kosher slaughtering by, once again, Paul Manafort. We recorded Argo Studios, which has cut a deal with Robert Mueller, and we're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.